Hi, everybody. My name is Cameron Munter, and I'm the CEO and president of the East-West Institute in New York. Welcome to EWI Podcast, a place where we try to dissect some of today's key global issues with leading thinkers. You can find all of our episodes on our website, on SoundCloud, and on iTunes, all under the name of East-West Institute. In this episode, I'm delighted to be speaking with a renowned name in international security, Nicholas Eberstadt, who holds the Henry Wendt Chair in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
Nick is also a prolific author and is a founding member of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, which brings us to our topic of discussion today, the current state of relations and negotiations between the United States and North Korea, as well as lessons from the Iran nuclear deal. Now, Nick, we have the North Korean summit coming up, so maybe we'll start with that. You've been outspoken about the possibilities and about the pitfalls of that summit. Perhaps you could comment on what you think might happen, what you think could happen that's good, what you think that could happen that would be tricky.
Sure. Well, if you look at the past generation of U.S. and Western diplomacy with North Korea, the conclusion that you can't avoid coming to is that North Korea wasn't a nuclear state when it began these deliberations, and it is a nuclear weapon state now. At least it's been testing nuclear devices and thermonuclear devices. North Korea seems to know what it's doing in its international diplomacy with the U.S. and the West, and that it's achieving the results that it wants to. And if the U.S. does not wish an indefinite continuation of North Korea's rise as a nuclear and now a ballistic missile state, we probably have to be doing something an awful lot different from what we've done under previous Republican and Democratic presidents. I'd say that the North Korean side, through three generations of Kims, has had a pretty consistent strategy, even though the tactics and gambits have sometimes changed. And that has been to push for unconditional reunification of the peninsula. And as a necessary but not a sufficient condition of achieving unconditional reunification, pushing to gain the nuclear and missile capabilities, which would allow Pyongyang to point a pistol at Uncle Sam's head to try to force him out of the Korean Peninsula. I wouldn't expect any of this has changed terribly much since the North Korean side invited the U.S. side to high-level discussions earlier this year. And I would expect the North Korean side to be very well briefed in its game plan for this. Whether the U.S. is up to a new approach to diplomacy to reduce these risks, I'm afraid, still is an open question.
Nick, on this, a couple of the terms that are used, like denuclearization, like reunification, are things that I think many people in the United States might understand somewhat differently, and even the president might understand somewhat differently than the North Koreans. When you talked about the unconditional reunification, would that be code for, or at least would that be symbolic of reunification on the terms of North Korea? And similarly with the question of denuclearization, can you speculate a little bit about what denuclearization means from a North Korean point of view?
Absolutely excellent spot on questions, because words matter and ideas matter. And the North Korean side has a very different understanding of the words that we're using from the U.S. and the West. When the North Korean side talks about independent reunification of the Korean Peninsula, that's a frequent phrase they use, independent doesn't mean voluntary. Independent means without foreign powers involved. And it actually means no help for South Korea from America. So it means just mano a mano. Very different from our understanding. And in the North Korean usage, independent reunification really is a sort of code language for the game doesn't stop until the North rules the whole thing. Denuclearization has a similarly mischievous set of definitions. when we talk about denuclearization, you know, fools that we are, we think that means no nuclear weapons, like in North Korea. DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, has a very different way of interpreting this. Their phraseology is denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Now, what does that mouthful mean? North Korean officials will explain it means the following. South Korea may seem to have no nuclear weapons placed on its soil, but it is in an alliance with a nuclear United States of America. And as long as it has a nuclear guarantor, it is a nuclear state. So we got to start by cutting the U.S.-ROK defense alliance. Let's say that happens. Even then, we're not ready to get around to what you and I might call the denuclearization of North Korea, because our North Korean friends will explain that is an arms control question, not a unilateral denuclearization question. If Uncle Sam is willing to reduce its nuclear arsenal to just 100 weapons, let's say, North Korea will be willing to do that too. But that's an arms control question to be taken on separately. So the terminology and the agendas behind the terminology are radically different.
In that case, I would imagine that someone who is, to put it charitably, not experienced in that kind of negotiations would need to have a team of persons around him who could make sure that he understands those ideas before he goes into his negotiations. But as you know, we're missing a lot of diplomats at state. We don't have an ambassador in Seoul. We don't have a special negotiator. Are you concerned that the president will go or may go into these talks without the subtle understanding that you've just articulated, and therefore there may be real misunderstandings about what people are talking about in June when they meet?
Well, I think we ought to give President Trump his due to begin with. He has come up with an approach to North Korean threat reduction, which is really quite different from any of his post-Cold War predecessors, and has put pieces in place which I think really start to form a coherent threat reduction strategy. He's spoken more eloquently about human rights in North Korea than any previous American president. And for good or for ill, he has used President Nixon's madman theory in a way which seems to have brought results in our alliance with the ROK and in the behavior of the Chinese government. Now, that's all background to the prospective meeting in Singapore in June. The way the North Korean side likes to do deals, you might think of the DPRK as sort of a nuclear-armed auto dealership from hell. They like to have, you know, the principals get in the room, make big concept declarations, you know, the face principles do that. And then everything gets duked out in the back of the dealership. And that's where the North Korean side always wins, or at least has in the past. We are certainly at risk of repeating history if we allow things to follow that same path. If the meeting turns out to be a sort of a big photo op where both sides talk about their aspirations, America loses. The president and the U.S. side, I think, for reasons of U.S. Security and security of our allies, we have to press the North Korean side very strictly about the past performance and about the particulars that we hope to achieve. And as per the Reykjavik example of Reagan in the 1980s, has to be able to walk away from a bad deal and explain why it was a bad deal and double down on North Korean threat reduction if it doesn't look like there's going to be a promising set of results.
So that question that you've made pretty clear is the president's done a pretty good strategic preparation, or at least has acted out strategically a series of steps that have made this possible in a way his predecessors haven't. But it does come to that question that I hear is implicit at the end, which is he will need to be able to recognize the particulars of what a bad deal is so as to walk out. And if that happens, I think you've said, here's a quote, that talks with North Korea are a zero-sum game and there should be no more good faith concessions. So that Trump, you would say, needs to be able to be a little hard line. Fair enough?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. Because we have to recognize that this isn't like a trade negotiation with Belgium. You know, the North Korean state is a revisionist state that regards the lay of the international landscape as fundamentally illegitimate. It regards the existence of South Korea as a state, the ROK, as illegitimate. It regards the U.S. security architecture, which has helped facilitate South Korea's flourishing, as illegitimate. And the corollaries of that are twofold. Number one, the North Korean side doesn't believe in win-win negotiations, believes in win-lose negotiations. And number two, because the North Korean side regards the international architecture as illegitimate, it also regards international laws as illegitimate. So that places people who rely upon traditional international legal arrangements in a terrible disadvantage.
You know, what's interesting about that is that one of the critiques that has come, and this other topic that we can turn to about the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, is that the critics of the president have said that by walking away from the JCPOA, that he gives a bad example about one keeping one's word for the North Korean talks. But what you've just said implies that there's kind of a different set of rules dealing with the North Koreans than there would be even with the Iranians. Is that a fair interpretation?
That is an absolutely fair interpretation. I am no specialist on Iran. Iran only crosses my radar screen when it is involved in proliferation with the DPRK, really. But and it's involved quite deeply in that. But the Islamic Republic of Iran is like an experiment in natural law compared to the DPRK government. It's like an experiment in consent of the governed compared to the DPRK. It's practically an open society compared to North Korea. So North Korea is the hardest, most extreme case outlier, I think, in the international constellation at the moment, and the most problematic state with which to try to negotiate any deal. And it's not just nuclear arrangements. Look at North Korea's record on abrogating or walking away from regular old plain vanilla foreign loans. If it doesn't agree to pay its loans, which are kind of like a low-level matter, how in the world can you expect the North Korean government to abide by nuclear agreements?
Your point that I think you've made quite eloquently is this is just a different ballgame. We're just playing differently because North Korea is, it's like comparing apples and Wednesday. You're dealing with a different kind of state than simply even in Iran. And therefore, what President Trump has done by breaking with the traditions of his predecessors is perhaps the most creative thing and one thing that gives more hope to these talks than one might have.
Well, He is a very different type of president from his predecessors, as we all know. And at the very least, this means that the North Korean side is having a very much tougher job in trying to figure out how to play him.
In your mind, does the North Korean side, is it possible that they are less interested in an agreement than in pocketing the prestige of having a meeting with the president, which none of President Trump's predecessors were willing to do? Do you think that the North Koreans want a deal or need a deal or willing to walk away, or is this something you can predict?
Well, based upon past behavior, I would think the North Korean side wants a deal on their own terms, a deal that helps facilitate their race to a credible nuclear arsenal and a credible long-range ballistic missile capability. They'd prefer to have a meeting in which sanctions are ended and the North Korean state resumes subsidies from the outside world at a much higher pace than currently enjoying. They'd like to come back from that meeting with a fracture in the U.S. ROK defensive alliance and with an isolation of the U.S. ally Japan. How much, if any, of that the North Korean side obtains still remains to be seen. You mentioned the important point of legitimacy from a meeting with the U.S. president, and that is far from negligible. But the sort of legitimacy that the North Korean side can accrue from that meeting depends very much upon how the U.S. president comports himself in these discussions and the points that the U.S. president presses. If the American president presses human rights, for example, it's going to be a very uncomfortable meeting with the North Korean dictator because North Korea is the human rights nightmare of the planet today. So the question of just how much legitimacy conveys is I think is open to deliberation and to the U.S. comportment. Also, at the end of the day, the North Korean side can't eat the photo op. They want economic benefits. The economic sanctions campaign, I think, is having an effect, and eventually, if continued and strengthened, will cripple the North Korean defense industries. That's something which we should want to see occur if the North Korean regime itself does not voluntarily relinquish its nukes and missiles.
You know, we've talked about this along the terms of a bilateral issue, a bilateral set of issues, the way that the United States will talk with North Korea. And indeed, it may not be that Japan or the ROK or China or even Russia can make a deal work. But do you think it's fair to say that if they don't like something about what the Americans and the North Koreans talk about, they can certainly make something fail? That is to say, their presence is not everything, but without their acquiescence, everything might be nothing. Is that too strong to say? What about those other countries, the Chinese, the Russians, the South Koreans, and the Japanese?
Well, of course, their cooperation in a North Korean threat reduction approach would be desirable and beneficial. But I guess I'm not part of the church of nothing can be done without China. I'm not an adherent to that particular diplomatic religion. I think an awful lot can be done without, in particular, China. And one of the reasons is this. China is much more exposed to vulnerabilities in this North Korean crisis than strategists and diplomats in the United States usually bother to reflect upon. I mean, just think of this one thing. Secondary financial sanctions by the U.S. government. The United States cannot command the Chinese government or Chinese firms not to engage furtively in trade with or support for the DPRK. U.S. Treasury Department, however, can decide which concerns and entities are allowed to enter into commerce in the U.S. dollar market. And unless you are the Vineshtorg Bank of China and deal only in ruble-denominated transactions with Russia, being denied access to the U.S. dollar market is a huge, big deal. And for most entities that deal internationally in trade and finance, being denied U.S. access is kind of like being beamed by the Death Star from Star Wars. The U.S. has a very powerful tool to use for dissuading and for compliance of China. We have used this tool very sparingly for a variety of reasons. But if it should happen that the Justice Department and the Treasury Department, for example, were to send a letter to the Bank of China informing the Bank of China that Washington was beginning an inquiry, not even using sanctions, but beginning an inquiry about Bank of China's compliance with U.S. sanctions on North Korea, the reverberations would be dramatic. And in fact, one of the reasons I suspect that Treasury has been so sparing in using this power that it possesses is for fear that it would be too strong an instrument, that it might create too much additional international financial turmoil. So we do have tools, if we wish to use them, that I think could be very conducive to compliance. As I say, one would want to be very sparing with these, but they are very powerful.
Those are very powerful, especially, as you've mentioned, in getting China to calculate the pros and cons of, you know, making various decisions. How about the others? How about Japan? How about South Korea? Is there a role for them,
sure,
or are they observers here?
Well, my impression is that the government of Japan and the U.S. government see pretty close to eye to eye on the North Korean threat reduction question. The government of Japan, I think, is perennially worried about being left out or abandoned by the U.S. in North Korean dealings and other security questions. We can assuage those insecurities, I think, quite easily. I as an American citizen, would hope that the U.S. president will represent Japan's very justified concerns about the abduction of Japanese citizens to North Korea, kind of like captives to help in their spy academies and so forth. I certainly would hope that our president will bring that up with the North Koreans if we meet. It's a different sort of question with South Korea. We've got an alliance with the ROK, but like our country, South Korea's politics is deeply polarized. And the current government in South Korea is of the sunshine variant that clings to a sort of a secular faith that is possible to have detente through engagement with the North. So far, the sunshine government under President Moon Jae-in and our government under President Trump, who are leaders ever slightly so different, have coordinated very, very closely. I can't tell you if that is because the South Korean government is afraid of the Nixon madman theory about President Trump and wants to keep him very close, or if this is because President Moon Jae-in is a pragmatist and has realized that there really isn't much of a future for sunshine unless the South and the U.S. coordinate very closely. Whichever way one looks at it, it's been a very much better relationship between Washington and Seoul under this third sunshine president than under the first two.
That's remarkable. How about the Russians? Do they play a role?
Well, the Kremlin is also an aggrieved international actor, and I don't think that there's anything more revealing than President for Life Putin's observation some time ago that the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century was the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So in the Korean Peninsula, as elsewhere, the Kremlin is looking for the restoration of influence. It hasn't done a very good job. The Kremlin has engaged in what you might call mischievous stratagems with Kim Jong-il and with Kim Jong-un back in the early days of Putin's presidency, signing a joint declaration with the previous North Korean dictator to the effect that Moscow and Pyongyang wish to see all American troops out of the Korean Peninsula. That's something that we must brook no delay upon. The mischievous suggestions that Moscow might launch North Korea's peaceful satellites for it and so forth. And more recently, since the accession of the Crimea, the Putin government's forgiving of ruble-denominated loans to North Korea, its declaration that there'd be a new ruble trade sphere with North Korea and that there'd be big money from Moscow and North Korea. All of that turned out to be pretty empty promises. Russia seems to remain a marginal player in the Korean Peninsula. Kremlin ambitions seem to be focused much more on the Western Front than the Eastern Front for the time being.
Well, look, Nick, we're coming to the end of our time here, and I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your perspectives with our audiences here at the East-West Institute. Do you have any projects you're working on for North Korea that you'd like to tell our audiences about?
I have a piece that appeared earlier this year in Commentary Magazine called Method and Kim's Madness, The Rational Statecraft of a Monstrous State. It's a look at North Korea's economy under the three Kims. And I make the argument that, surprising as it may seem, there's been a bit of an economic upsurge under the third Kim, that he has had a rather more pragmatic policy than his father and his grandfather. But ironically, this improvement in consumer economy has helped to fund the missile and the nuke program, and that the upsurge, a limited upsurge in consumer economics in North Korea, is part of the danger that we face today. I argue in this piece that we may yet be able to break the North Korean defense economy through strict enforcement of sanctions and through redoubled economic pressure, because North Korea is really a sort of a poster child for successful sanctions. Sanctions usually don't work that well in international diplomacy, as we know. But the North Korean economy is so distorted and so dependent on outside largesse that I think we still have a chance before it's too late.
It's an interesting idea, and it does focus away from the notion of Kim Jong-un as a madman and much more as a pragmatist in that sense, if he's actually been able to achieve some economic reform. And yet, a country that achieves something, you might say, has something more to lose and then may be more susceptible to sanctions and things of that sort. Would that be generally what you would think?
I don't think there's anything that we can do to dissuade the North Korean leadership from wishing to be a nuclear power and to preparing for and eventually getting to a place where it can fight and win a limited nuclear war against the U.S. and our allies in the Korean Peninsula. I don't think we can change their intentions. I do think we can affect and maybe even severely alter their capabilities. And that would be what I would argue for. We don't need North Korean permission to do the latter.
Excellent. Well, Nick, thanks for a very clear and very cogent assessment here on the verge of these very important talks that will take place mid-June in Singapore. And from those of us at the East-West Institute, remember to look for us on our website, SoundCloud, and iTunes under the name of East-West Institute, where you can enjoy our various conversations, including this one with Nick Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks very, very much, Nick. Thanks for being with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.